The Lord is coming to Israel as he himself prophesied. The section near the end of chapter 9 that we looked at last week started a section after it discussed Alexander coming, after it discussed the Maccabees and the other persecutions that the Jews were going to win. They're going to win, but they still had to suffer these things. They still had to win the battles. And God said, I'm going to be the one doing this, but I'm going to use you. Well, we're going to look at a section today from, it's actually Zechariah 16, 9:16 to 10:4. And I'll read the whole section where it says, and Jehovah, their God, will save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted on high over his land. For how great is his goodness and how great is his beauty. Grain shall make the young men flourish and new wines the virgins. Ask ye of Jehovah rain in the time of the latter rain, even of Jehovah that maketh lightnings, and he will give them showers of rain to everyone grass in the field. For the teraphim have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and they have told false dreams. They comfort in vain, therefore they go their way like sheep and are afflicted. Because there is no shepherd, my anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the he-goats. For Jehovah of hosts has finished his flock, visited his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them as his goodly horse in the battle. From him shall come forth the cornerstone, from him the nail, from him the battle bow, from him every ruler together. Amen. The world is going to realize Israel's deliverance. The world is going to know this. The first stage of this that has happened, them coming back to the land, is just a precursor for what's going to happen in the millennium. They're back there now in unbelief. The 37th chapter of Ezekiel describes them being back in belief. They're not there yet. They're not there yet. We can look at the 20th chapter of Ezekiel, and it says that they're going to come back to the land after a persecution and before a persecution. That's what it says. They are back. They know that they're back. And they're still apostate for the most part. But God's promises are taking them slowly in and then forcing them through the end of the Great Tribulation to confess who the Messiah is. And as we get nearer to the end of this book, I'm going to go into great detail about the campaign of Armageddon and the status of the circumstances in the millennial kingdom that gets described primarily in Isaiah, but somewhat here too. Now, the first verse that we looked at there is the 16th verse of the 9th chapter, where it says, and Jehovah their God will save them in that day as the flock of his people. For they shall be as the stones of a crown lifted on high over his land. Now, what God's doing here is he's saying that the terrible trials that we've been talking about here over the term that day is indicative of this final prophetic era, this final eschatological is the term used in theology. Eschatology just means the doctrine of the end times or future things. They are going to end up as the head of the people of this world. Now, Deuteronomy says that now they're the tail, but then they'll be the head. They are going to be restated back to a theocratic kingdom with Jesus as the head on the throne in Jerusalem. They're going to be delivered to their from their enemies because of the godly promised covenants. He says, I promised these things to the patriarchs, so I'm going to do them. Leviticus 26, Romans 9, and so on. God always does what he says he's going to do. He always does what he said he's going to do. You know, all he wants us to do is love him and obey him. One of the professors that I have read extensively, and I haven't met the man because he's gone to be with the Lord, but at a conference he was at with some of the other teachers I had. They're talking about the future, and they're talking about the Old Testament books. And he says, you know, this is really simple. Just do what he says. Just do what he says. That's it. That's it. Everything else will fall into place. And you still don't want to do it. You still don't want to do it. Love and obey him. They will be permanently saved. The Jews will be at the second coming. And we're going to see when we get around the 13th and 14th chapter exactly what happens. I mean, the leaders instruct the family members of the different families that are believers to start killing their children and their siblings and their siblings and their wives that are not believers and are occultists. Wipe them out. Get rid of them. It's the only way to stop it. No, yeah, we can't do anything like that today, but that's what's going to happen then. That's what's going to happen then. You know, the Jews would constantly over time say, oh, yes, we love God. We love you. We're going to do everything you want, you know. Look at Exodus 19:8. And look that up after you leave. In Exodus 19:8, they're about to get the Mosaic Covenant. God has made himself clear, coming down on the mountain, lightnings, thunder, a big cloud. And where are they? They're there saying, whoa, we're going to do all you want, everything you want. And then shortly after that, while Moses is up on the mountain, it's taken him some time to get 613 commandments, plus the design for the tabernacle. I mean, he gets a set of blueprints that are just incredibly detailed. So he's up there a while. He comes down, and here's the Israelites. They melted their earrings, and they made a golden calf out of this, and they're having this drug-fueled orgy and worshiping this golden calf. And Aaron, the high priest, is leading the thing. What? You know, what are you doing? Moses breaks the tablets of the Old Testament. He had to get new ones. That's the sinful ways of humankind. That's what happens. And the Jews are no different, but they will not do that at the second coming. They will all be saved. It'll be entirely different. They will be restored, spiritually redeemed, and as Paul says in Romans 11, they will all be saved. They'll have this status that has been given to them that they didn't appropriate. And it's interesting is the Bible uses these words, lo ami. Lo in Hebrew means no or not. Am is people. And e, attached to the end of a word, means me or mine. Lo ami, my, not my people. And just like he uses this in old Hosea, he's going to say, you then will be ami. You will be my people. And he's essentially saying that the protected ones will be the Jews underneath the Good Shepherd. Finally. And the new covenant in Jeremiah 31 will finally be active and completed. God wants to be their shepherd. You know, Jesus is called the gentle Good Shepherd. And what it's just like, read Psalm 23. It's just a beautiful picture of God wanting us to want him and nothing else. Want him and nothing else. He's going to seek, deliver, gather, and tend to them as a shepherd does to his flock. You know, Isaiah probably has some of the most of the messianic passages. And one of them from chapter 40, verse 10 and 11 says, behold, the Lord Jehovah will come as a mighty one, and his arm will rule for him. Behold, his reward is with him, and his recompense before him. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arm and carry them in his bosom, and will gently lead those that have their young. Feed his flock like a shepherd, gather the lambs in his arms, and carry them in his bosoms. Finally, at the second coming, the Jews who have rejected him for these 2,000 years and pushed away God for a couple thousand more years are going to be permanently knit together with God and will be permanently saved and running the world, essentially, under King Jesus. Now, these folks are going to look really attractive. Even today, there is something attractive about someone that knows God to others. They see some peace. They see some understanding. They see something within the people, and they wonder what it is. It's one of the reasons why the Jews were given so much in the Mosaic Covenant, to distance themselves from the world. They were given hygienic practices the world didn't have, social practices, knit together with God, sanitary practices, so that they would be different from the rest of the people in the world. I mean, the medicinal practices, even the sanitary practices that came out of them was just phenomenal. People didn't know these things. People didn't know about digging latrines, and people didn't know about isolating people with diseases that couldn't be cured. It's phenomenal what they did. Well, in the millennium, they're going to be the shining bright star on the crown, as Jesus said. The attractiveness has been mentioned before. Look what the 8th chapter and the 23rd verse says. Thus saith Jehovah of hosts, in those days it shall come to pass that 10 men shall take hold out of all the languages of nations, and they shall hold of the skirt, take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew, saying, we will go with you, for we have heard that God is with you. That's how attractive they're going to be. And the Gentiles are going to be serving them. Their presence in the millennial kingdom is going to radiate out like sparkling stones set in a crown. God uses the same imagery in Malachi. He says there in chapter 3, verse 17, and they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels. And jewels are precious. Jewels are precious. They're stones that have great value, especially to the ladies. And that's what God is doing here. He's giving this imagery about jewels in a crown, and he's the crown. He wears the crown. The crown always separates somebody from others. The high priest was separated from the regular priest by wearing it. The Hebrew word for a crown is a netzer, and it comes from a root of nazar, means to separate or to separate out. The Nazarite, which is another form of that, was an individual who was specifically chosen and dedicated to God, and they had to perform certain functions and shave their heads and or grow them long. I don't remember exactly how they worked it, but the Nazarite was set apart for service to God. These folks here are going to be set apart finally in their salvation in a sparkling manner to the world that's going to serve them. You know, what's interesting is the jewel in the crown is a statement that Benjamin Disraeli used in the mid-1800s. He was the only Jewish prime minister of England. And he used this in a statement, in a talk, I think it was like 1872, and he referred to India as the jewel in the crown. The jewel in the crown, meaning it was their greatest possession because of all that they got out of that country. When Jesus comes back, he's the King of Kings. He's going to wear many crowns. And the crowns described in Revelation 19 are diadems. And a diadem is a crown that only royalty can wear. A Stephanos in Greek is a crown that somebody wins for some meritorious activity, like you're a victor in a running race or something. But Jesus wears diadems. And in him, there will be many crowns. And the jewel in the crown is going to be the redeemed Jews at that time. Now, Israel is going to have more blessings in the Messianic kingdom than they can ever imagine. The next verse says, for how great is his goodness and how great is his beauty. Grain shall make the young men flourish and new wines the virgin. This just epitomizes the typical biblical language about abundance, just lots and lots of abundance. And grain and wine are staple products in the Holy Land, and they're just mentioned together in the Bible and in a number of different places, Genesis, Joel, Haggai, indicating abundance, a lot. And there's going to be an incredible amount of produce, an incredible amount of things. Everybody's going to have them. The young ladies are going to have them. The young men are going to have them. Everybody's going to have this abundance. And when Israel is converted, they shall be as precious stones of a crown lifted up over his land. They're going to have more abundance than they can ever imagine. And that's this outward sign. Grain shall make the young men cheerful, literally to grow. Or to increase, and as well as the new wine for the maidens. The Prince of Peace is the Lord Jesus. And starting into the next chapter, in the first verse, the text says, "Ask ye of Jehovah rain at the time of the latter rain, even of Jehovah that maketh lightnings, and he will give them showers of rain to everyone, grass in the field." Now, the chapter just continues on the blessings that started in the last chapter, or finished near the end of the last chapter. And as a result of the second coming, a new grain and a new wine for abundance is going to be coupled with the latter rain. Now, this is a specific prophetic term. It talks about a pouring out of blessing. And that blessing includes genuine rain, because he's talking about that. Hosea speaks about this people coming at the end times as the rain, as the latter rain that waters the whole earth. And Joel also associated it with a time of abundant harvest of wheat, vineyards, olive trees. All of these things need the rain. The rain is gentle shower, copious shower, that's going to soak the land and allow everything to grow. And remember, the sun is going to have a sevenfold increase in the speed of light. The produce that's going to come during the Messianic period is going to be incredibly abundant, more so than anything that we can grow now, more so. You know, Israel has been blessed with an incredible amount of abundance since they came back in 1948. And it's because of their scientific technologies and irrigation techniques. And they produce a lot of food for the Middle East and Europe and Western Asia. But the abundance that's going to come in the Messianic kingdom is going to far outdistance this. And I put a lot of verses down in your notes attesting to that. And at the same time he's telling them how they're going to be blessed, he turns then to the false prophets and he tells them that they're condemned. They're condemned, and he doesn't want anybody listening to him. Look what he says. "For the teraphim have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and they have told false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, they go their way like sheep. They are afflicted because there is no shepherd." Now, this follows the verse about all the blessings. And then he says, "In the past, you people relied on these idols." You relied on these idols. It's pagan occultism and spiritual paganism and spiritual fornication, he calls it, for their spiritual sustenance. And he's intent now on exposing this so that they understand where the lies came from. And he gives two types of deception here. He talks about these teraphim and he talks about the diviners. Teraphim were household idols. Was like, well, you can't afford to go to the pagan temple where they got these big idols, you know. We got these little ones you can buy, you know. You just take this one home and, you know, you can ask for things for your family with the teraphim. And people believe this stuff. They believe that. Look what he's saying. He's saying here that this is nonsense. He calls it vanity. They're speaking nonsense. I mean, we'd look at that and we'd say, "Boy, you're speaking to that chair like it's really going to do something for you here. I don't get it." Well, that's what they did, though. They looked at these things, and, you know, there's plenty of people doing this today, too. Plenty of people doing this today, believing that idols, somehow or other, that don't speak, that can't think, are going to do things for people. Now, what they did back then is they would take these things and they would ask them questions about how is this uncertain thing going to come out for me? You know, I got this thing coming up and I want to know if this going to, are you going to help me or what? Well, it's absolutely absurd to think that there's any realistic communication going to come from them. But what happens on the other side? The demons see this and they come into these things. It's a gateway to the occult. By putting faith in these crazy things, it's a gateway to the occult. So they come in and they deceive these things. And if there's any outcome that is positive, people start being more and more attracted to them. And the demons then have a particular foothold, if you will, into the individual using these things. Well, here's God saying, don't do this. Don't do this. You know, to us it just sounds so stupid that somebody would be talking to some little statue, but that's where the demons come in. It's like playing with a Ouija board or something like this, and you look at it and you say, hey, that's absolutely crazy. It's demonic. And the more time somebody spends on these things, it's another entrance for the demons to break through and start to antagonize us. The demons can't possess a true believer. You can't do it. They can irritate you if you start fooling with them in these mediums, or if you're drunk and continuing to get drunk or drug-induced, they enter that way. They enter through somebody that gets steeped in horoscopes and crazy things like that. And God's saying, get out, get out, get away from that, get away from it. And the Jews loved these things. They loved them. I'm not saying now, I'm saying back then, because that's what this is discussing. There's three fundamental problems with them. As I said, they were a gateway to the occult. And whenever there's a successful outcome, the demonic intervention gets into that family. One, stay away, stay away. Two, the people that were using these things were using them to replace a reliance on genuine God. And here he is saying, don't do that. Don't do that. And finally, they were forbidden. Under the Mosaic Covenant, they were forbidden under their law to do this. But the Israelites kept them anyway. Kept them anyway. Said, well, I'll just keep one just in case, you know. Things aren't going too well today. I better go see that. I know God's supposed to be helping me, but I'm going to go talk to this teraphim anyway. You remember back to the story of Rachel and Laban and Jacob, when they were leaving Laban, somehow or other, Rachel put the family teraphim, they were pagans, you know, they put the family teraphim in her bags and they were leaving. You know, and it's not clear from the text why she did that. Maybe somebody did it to her. Maybe Laban did it so he could come back and then try and get her back again, even though he gave her after 14 years to Jacob. But the family teraphim got stolen somehow, and it was found with Rachel. She was hiding it. And, you know, this was a valuable commodity. People really thought, hey, I mean, this is the good luck charm. You know, if I don't have this, boy, life's going to be dismal. I'm not going to be able to go on. They relied on these things. They relied on them. The second category that he brings out here are the mediums, the soothsayers, the fortune tellers. They're false prophets. That's all, just false prophets. Text says, have told false dreams and they comfort in vain. In other words, they're giving you comfort when they can't. And you're believing this. They're lying to you and you are not wanting to believe they are. You're accepting what they're saying. And he says, therefore, they went their way as a flock. Now, God clearly told the Israelites just before they came into the promised land, stay away from the Canaanites, stay away from these false prophets. They did it anyway. They went and they wedded themselves to these people because it sounded really good. You know, they've got God appearing to them in the Shekinah glory, but they still drift off and they listen to some false prophet. It's like, wait a minute, you just had the truth. How can you listen to this? You know, the first king of the United Monarchy was Saul. Saul, knowing the Mosaic Covenant, had instituted laws against, he instituted laws for the population against fooling with these diviners, staying away from them. So what does he do? He's going into a battle with the Philistines, and he says, I better go ask the witch of Endor here what's going on. I want to know, am I going to win? That's unbelievable. She doesn't realize who he is right away, and she's saying, hey, the king has told me I can't do this sort of stuff. Yeah, go ahead, I'm him, What? So he asks what's going to happen to him. And what ends up happening is he and his three kids die. He commits suicide. And the three kids die. They trusted in the wrong things. They were troubled. They were oppressed. And because there was no genuine shepherd, their kings had gone south, sour. And they were following the false prophets. You look at the book of Jeremiah, he is just distraught. These people are listening to these false prophets. The king's listening to the false prophets. They wouldn't listen to him. They had no righteous king to guard them and to push them to the true prophets of God. So they fell under foreign powers and they were taken away. And I'll tell you what, the same thing will happen to us. Same thing will happen to us when we have leaders that draw us away from God. God will intervene sooner or later and give us what we want, which is what is being espoused. Some ungodly behavior. Now, this is what happens. God says in the third verse in the 10th chapter, "Mine anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the he-goats. For Jehovah of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and will make them as his goodly horse in the battle." So he's making it real clear. I'm mad with these folks. I'm mad with these bad kings, the false prophets, and the demons, who he's referring to as the he-goats, that are the instigators of all of the bad stuff. The Apostle Paul, if I can remind you, at the end of the book of Ephesians, says we don't have a physical battle. It's a spiritual battle. There's wickedness in heavenly places. That's what the battle is. It gets manifested out in the physical and time and space, but that's not its origin. That's not its origin. The Old Testament frequently makes use of a representation of the demons as he-goats. And sometimes it's translated as demons, sometimes it's translated as he-goats. So sometimes it's what the entity is, and sometimes it's the actual word that's used in the Old Testament. It's a complete attack by the gods of the Canaanites, which is just a bunch of demons that they were supposed to stay away from, but they fell victim to because they married into their families. They had a close relationship with them, and they started following those ugly practices. For example, in 2 Chronicles 11:15, the New King translates the word as devils. And in the New Revised Standard Version, it's goat demons. So, these words are really common. He-goat is in Genesis 37:1, and it's 53 times in the Hebrew text that all of our Old Testament Bibles are based on, which is the Masoretic text. And there's even a couple times they refer to a she-goat in Leviticus 4:28 and 5:6, but basically, it just refers to a demon, directly forbidden, and they did it anyway. They did it anyway. The Old Testament just frequently talks about them not doing this. Don't do this. This is the source of these things. And God says, I'm going to get them too. There will be an end to this demonic activity. For the whole thousand-year millennium, Satan is going to be chained in darkness for a thousand years, and then he will be let go at the end of that. There will be a short fight. It won't last long, and then they will all go into the lake of fire. That's where they end up. That's where they end up. And the text moves on in... I'm going to move it on to Isaiah 13, verses 19 to 22, because there's a vivid description there about Babylon, which is going to be the world headquarters of the Antichrist and the one world government when that finally gets set up. Babylon, you know, has been mostly restored by Saddam Hussein, and it's in really good shape. It had fallen into disrepair, and there's always been a few people living there. But this passage that I'm going to read to you from Isaiah 13, verses 19 to 22, talks about Babylon going down and never being inhabited again except by the demons. And the imagery in the Old Testament, Hebrew words, is about these really unique animals. They're not normal animals, and they're kind of exotic. But that's the terminology that the Old Testament uses to refer to demons. The text reads, "And Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' pride, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall shepherds make their flocks to lie down there, but wild beasts of the desert shall lie there. And their houses shall be full of doleful creatures, and ostriches shall dwell there, and wild goats shall dance there, and wolves shall cry in their castles, and jackals in the pleasant palaces. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged." So what it's saying is that it's just going to be inhabited by demons. And these animals are the representation of the demons in Isaiah. "Jehovah of hosts has visited his flock, which is the house of Judah. He's going to make them as his goodly horse in the battle." So the Israelites are going to be delivered from the oppression. And he's saying, "I'm going to use them like a stately war horse adorned with beautiful cloth and leather and jewels, like a horse in a ceremony of some sort, in a parade of some sort." And he's used this war imagery before. We saw that in chapter 9:13, where he's talking about using Judah as a bow and Ephraim as his arrow. And then I'm going to finish with this last verse here about the cornerstone that he speaks of. Zechariah 10:4, the Messiah is the cornerstone. And what he says is, "From him shall come forth the cornerstone, from him the nail, from him the battle bow, from him every ruler together." Now, the cornerstone term is a messianic term, and it's used throughout the Bible. Paul uses it, too, in the New Testament. Isaiah 28, verses 16 to 17 says, "Therefore, thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I lay in Zion a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone of sure foundation. He that believeth shall not be in haste. And I will make justice the line and righteousness the plummet, and hail shall sweep away the refuge of lies, and the water shall overflow the hiding places." So Isaiah is issuing this warning that anybody that's made lies their refuge and hid under these lies are going to be revealed. They're going to be revealed because no one can hide from God, and they will be exposed. And he's calling the Messiah the Deliverer. Isaiah and both Zechariah describe this God-man Jesus as the cornerstone. And he will revive the kingdom, the theocratic kingdom, in a way that it never was in the theocracy under the kings. Paul says that Christ is the chief cornerstone in Ephesians 2:20. And the cornerstone, the nail, the battle bow, they're all metaphorical ways of speaking about the positions and the responsibility and the prominence of the Messiah, God, in the kingdom. The nail means it's one that's used for building or tightening together or hanging things on, and it's a reference to the consolidation of and upholding the political constitution, which is going to be God's law. And true justice and righteousness are going to be the law of the government of the world when Christ is reigning as the Messiah. This battle bow is a symbol of power and authority. In the ancient world, you know, you look at some of these old reliefs, kings are always shown pulling the bow back, you know, and firing an arrow. It's a symbol of big power and big authority. And so that's the imagery that's used here to describe the Messiah in the Messianic kingdom. God is coming. He's coming back. He's going to take his world back. He's promised he's going to do that. You know, and it's interesting that Peter says, he gives us this exposition, and the people say, where is he? You know, you say he's coming, but come on, he's not coming back. Where is he? And they will be most surprised when he comes back because they don't believe. Amen?